Thank you. Well, I hope this works. Does the microphone work?
Yeah.
Oh, great. I mean, I have to say that I'm standing here in front of you with some trepidation because I did indeed go to the LSE, and my tutor is Marcus Miller, who's just over there. And I find myself, as you probably know, Marcus, now being a governor of the LSE, which is an amazing privilege. I'm on the court. And I remember those days when I was a struggling undergraduate. So I'm delighted to be here. I was actually here just relatively recently, maybe it was a year ago or 2 years ago, with my hat as joint head of the Government Economic Service, talking to your predecessors about what we in government needed from economists who graduated from places like Warwick, which wasn't always what we were offered. In terms of understanding public policy and so on. So I think what you heard from Avinay about the link between private and public is really important. And I have had a career which spans both. I'm now back in the private sector. But it is quite extraordinary what different skills you need when you're in the public sector, and also how you learn to look at things from quite a different way. And I'm hoping that what I'm going to talk about today is going to sort of cover both. But what I thought I'd do is really not talk for more than 20 minutes, half an hour, and then open it up so that we can have a discussion on this. But there is a crucial point that Avinay did not mention. The book is called Greekonomics, and I have been quite a commentator on sort of trends in the UK, saying various things about what Osborne should do in the autumn statement, what have you, commenting this morning, strangely enough, about Boris Johnson's view, which I did on the BBC, that the EU referendum, if there is one for the UK, should not be a straight yes or no, but should actually be a sort of qualifying one and should look at things differently. So you do get drawn into this. And of course, I was doing that for some time. Well, you're a faceless civil servant, you can't do that. But when I left again, I started being quite active in this. And there was this one day when, of course, Greece had become rather important in the Eurozone, and people all were saying, gosh, you know, if only Greece was just chucked out, wouldn't it be all fine and we can solve all the problems out there? And of course, there were crucial votes in Greece. It was extraordinary that as we were approaching the various elections, because there were two in the summer in Greece, one was a real protest one and then the other one finally had some sensible results, that the names of the various leaders in Greece had become household names here in the UK. And the House of Parliament, which were constantly pelted by, you know, petrol bombs, and there were fights out in the street all the time between sort of protesters and the police, had become a sort of nightly show on TV here. And I was doing a Sky thing, I think, and we were seeing live the debate in Greece, and there was a pause in this, and they said something, and the guy said, "What are they saying?" I was actually, you know, on full public view, and I stupidly translated. And of course, they all realized that I'm Greek, Greek-born. And of course, from then on, I became a sort of Greek expert. So I had to write this book, in a way. I had no other choice. But what I found myself being is the one voice that has had something semi-positive to say about the Greeks, and also something to say about why it was such a stupid idea to not help Greece and to let it, if you like, default leave the Eurozone. Because, of course, there would be such huge problems in so many other countries, which is precisely, of course, what we've seen, because everything's been taking so long that contagion has spread, and there are countries now such as Spain and Italy, and not just the periphery countries of old, such as Ireland, Portugal and Greece, and now, of course, also Cyprus, having this difficulty, but big countries in Europe which are in trouble as a result of not having dealt with what basically is still a serious banking and sovereign crisis across the Eurozone. But also found that there were caricatures that were developing all across. You know, the Greeks were described as lazy and corrupt, and they much preferred to stay on the beach. You could blame them, really. They didn't like to pay their taxes. They mistrusted government. I mean, a considerable amount of that is true. I have to admit, yeah, the Greeks don't like paying taxes because they see the taxes being wasted, used to buy political favours. It's no different, actually, to what's been going on in places like Italy for decades, if not centuries. Of course, you've got to think of how all these countries have been put together, which is relatively recent. But they all have come together being quite separate before and really mistrusting whoever ruled them from the center, whether it was the Ottoman Empire in the past or whether it's some central government in Madrid. Look what's going on right now with the Catalans, for example. And look at southern Italy, where, of course, you've had lawlessness and the mafia for a long time. The Greeks would be a bit like that, too, if only they could get themselves organized, but they can't. So there's no real mafia, except the imported one, which comes from particularly some of the Eastern European countries that have basically made their home now in Greece and have operate through there. So I was rather glad, in a way, when all the other countries started getting into difficulty. And I used to say, look, if you just look at the list of things that the Greeks are meant to do, including opening up the markets into, you know, proper competition, so the labour, you know, can actually flow into the right places and you can improve your competitiveness and productivity, which had suffered so significantly during the euro, you can just cross out Greece and write Italy or Spain. Now Spain. And it would be the same. Now Spain is interesting because everyone says, oh, well, Spain is different, and et cetera, et cetera. Well, not at all. It has one of the highest black market economies that you can think of. It's just not obvious. Why do you think the Spaniards have put up with such huge unemployment rates for a very long time? It's interesting because Spanish unemployment rate, which is at 25% now, same as in Greece, has been very high for a long time. Even in the boom years, it was difficult to get it below 11. And that is because there are structural problems in the economy, but also because people have tolerated it for quite some time because they have second and third jobs. Now, the moment the second and third jobs go, it's going to be, which is going to be happening, now there are more austerity measures introduced in Spain too to avoid having to go for a proper bailout. You will find that there are similar protests like in Greece where poverty levels have increased very substantially. And I will explain, of course, why this is the case. Once you take away the ability to react to changes in your environment or any external shocks by doing something in with your exchange rate or by and therefore devaluing, or by changing monetary policy and interest rates, then you have nothing left if there is a shock except internal devaluation. What does that mean? It means slashing wages continuously to a point where your living standards drop so significantly and you end up increasing your poverty levels very substantially, because at the same time as you're doing all this, in order to improve your deficit to GDP ratio and to reduce your debt to GDP ratio, supposedly, you raise taxes. So living standards are slashed because you cut pensions, you cut wages, and then taxes like VAT, wealth taxes, go up, which means that your living standards are very squeezed. So across Europe now, and it becomes increasingly the case the more austerity measures are imposed, you have all these countries which have no ability to spend, where the improvement in the balance of payments that has taken place in a number of them, including Greece, is because no one is buying anything anymore. Whereas before, once you removed the balance of payments constraint when you joined the euro, you find that everyone was just buying German goods because no one worried about the exchange rate anymore. You know, why should we buy anything produced in Greece or Italy or what have you? Why don't we just buy Porsches and BMWs with the money that we are making? Because there is also very, very cheap credit. Remember, the euro resulted in all these countries, even though they shouldn't really have fed that regime in terms of the low interest rates, being able to borrow incredibly cheaply, lent to them by the German banks, which are now, you know, and the Germans, which are now, of course, complaining about having to bail out Greece. The Germans financed the housing boom in Spain, which has ended in tears. The French and Germans financed the boom, the lending boom in Greece, bought banks. The reason why Lagarde, who now heads the IMF, when she was finance minister, was very keen to rescue Greece was because she knew what the implications would be for her own banking system if the Greek banks went under. These interconnections were really very significant in this whole thing, and they were just not understood by the EU leaders. So the subtitle of my book, it says The Euro Crisis and Why Politicians Don't Get It. They seemed to think that there was Greece not behaving, an exceptional country, out there, it is slightly an outlier, I have to admit. The system is useless. It has the most inefficient public sector of any that the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, has ever seen. And they produced a really castigating report on this, which I have reproduced in the book. I'm not feeling at all proud about this. And indeed, they can't get anything done. They can't implement any of the stuff that they're supposed to implement. But on the other hand, it was because everyone around them, of course, in terms of the economic environment, was also having to impose austerity measures at the same time. And everyone was seeing the GDP collapsing, if you like. And therefore, there was absolutely no way in which you could have an export-fueled recovery of the sort that the IMF and others wanted to do, even if you did all your structural reforms that were supposed to do. So we go back then to basics. The euro was a political decision. It was not an economic concept. Of course, after the single market, which actually is still not complete, for those of you who've looked at Europe, it's clear that on the good side, we've actually had a pretty sort of good progress towards achieving a single market. In terms of services, we're still miles away from doing so. Banking, not at all. Look at insurance, not at all. So it's a myth that we have a single market. But nevertheless, there was an economic reason for going to the euro, which is that if you instead had what was there before, which is the European exchange rate mechanism, which meant they were all linked together and had to keep it at a certain rate around the Deutschmark in particular, capital flows could really kill you because there would be so much pressure on a particular currency, as there was against the UK, against sterling. You have to raise your interest rates, and you just can't do it. Whereas if you at least have a single currency, there wouldn't be that pressure at all. So capital would flow, and it would be very, very good for most of the economies. And so there was one simple reason that made sense. But the rest of it was political. And of course, nobody understood that the pressures that were out there for countries to behave, in other words, to keep their deficit to GDP ratios under control and the debt to GDP ratio control, were not at all rigid. There was a Stability and Growth Pact. Everyone ignored it. The Germans ignored it. The French ignored it. They blamed the Greeks, but the Greeks, of course, had no chance of even being close to them. So if you just look at whether this was an optimal currency area. But it's probably worth remembering what an optimal currency area is. Now, it's slightly subjective. If you have the politics right, so if you're determined to make it work, like the US, then you can have a currency area that works. But it requires you to have transfers of money from the rich to the poor if there is an issue. Or those who are doing badly, they don't necessarily have to be poor, but those who are going through some sort of cycle which is not particularly good, you have transfers. And it requires all sorts of other things. It requires labour mobility. It has to be easy for workers to be located from one part of the currency area to another. Now, you would say that perhaps it is easy. Look at all these migrants who have come into the UK. Look at all of you. I presume there are loads and loads of foreigners amongst you, like I was. But what you really need is to have the same qualification, so it's all sort of recognised. So you have to speak the same language, I suppose, or at least you have to, should be able to do that. And we are a long way from having linguistic and cultural barriers being lifted. So that hasn't happened. Although, you know, clearly, if everyone adopts the English as a language, that might make it easier. But so far, we haven't really got to that point. And of course, what you don't have is the same treatment of housing benefits, the same treatment of your pension that you can take with you, and so on. So we're still not there. Similarly, for an optimal currency, you need capital mobility. Money needs to be free to flow. You would think it does, because indeed there's foreign direct investment going all over the place. There's loads and loads of money sort of getting into one banking system, then moving into another across countries, and so on. But actually, there's quite a lot that still isn't there. Again, there are different rules in terms of how your savings are treated. Just look right now across Europe. Why do we want a banking union? So that everyone, well, at least we move to something which resembles sort of a single market in this. So there are still issues in terms of where you put your savings, how easy it is to open an account in another country. They try and do that now. Money laundering has worried everyone hugely. But also you've got all these other controls, such as takeover rules, which are very different from country to country. Forget the takeover directive and all that sort of stuff which the Europeans have tried to do. There's still differences, very significant differences, on what is considered to be strategic, how easy it is to actually get into a market, the role of the capital markets very significantly as well. And you then also need wage and price flexibility. Now, look at the labour systems across Europe. They are still hugely different. And what is being tried right now in some of the countries that really need to change, including Greece, but also Spain, and also Portugal, and also Italy, is to look at ways in which the markets can be opened up so that levels, you know, wage levels can also move in the right way. You still have countries where the structure of the economy is such that for a given interest rate, you get much more inflation than you do in others. So the moment that if the markets don't work properly, then you clearly have loads of different countries there which cannot, therefore, be run from the centre with just one monetary policy. So this is a very, very clear way in which you look at this. I talked a little bit about pensions, but if you also have the tax and social security being different, then again, you first of all, you limit the movement of people, but you also limit the movement of capital and companies. Look at the what's going on right now in the UK. Because we have a relatively high corporation tax, we end up with big companies relocating elsewhere and actually paying very little in the UK. And then you have differences in how regions try and attract investment into their areas. So you have still huge amount of difference across. And then, of course, you have no convergence in the sense that the cycles seem to be different. The economies are still very different. And there, of course, the signs that we have seen so far suggest that actually, if anything, instead of convergence, the countries have moved even further apart. So we started with the rather difficult task of putting all these countries together. And then, of course, you had countries like Greece, which joined the single market. Nobody really paid very much attention to that. It was a small place, less than 2% of GDP in Europe. And it didn't offer any serious competitive challenges to the likes of France, which was much more interested in the common agricultural policy and making sure it got a lot of money into its farmers, than it really, you know, worried about Greece, which was small but not very important. It worried much more about Spain. So Greece entered the EU, even though it actually had a market economy that wasn't working. Greece is still a Soviet-style economy with loads and loads of controls there in terms of how it operates. But at least it did it proud in a way because it opened, the markets opened up and costs went down very significantly and so on. So you could just about justify that, even though there was a lot more attention paid to Spain and Portugal when they joined, whether they were meeting the various conditions. And the conditions are you have to have a market economy and not a dictatorship, so it has to be a democracy as well. But the euro, it made absolutely no sense, because Greece basically cheated to get in, very significantly. So it didn't have a debt to GDP ratio of 60%, it had a debt to GDP ratio of 100% and growing. But of course, lots of other countries did the same. So the 60% was the supposed aim, but actually lots of places, including sort of Germany, joined at slightly higher than that. And look at Italy, it had 120% for a very long time. And then inflation. If you remember, those of you who have studied it, you wouldn't remember necessarily, but if you've read about this, there was another rule which said that countries can join if their inflation rate is 1.5% above or below the sort of average for the other countries. And of course, Greece has a higher inflation rate generally than others because of the reasons that I explained. And it went into a sort of full throttle administrative controls to bring prices down for the month in which it was all being calculated. So those of you who go on holiday in Greece, you'd probably, you know, here you buy a bottle of water. I didn't think we had enough money to buy one from there, which can be anything up to, you know, £2.50 if you're unlucky on a motorway station, sometimes even higher, but you can buy it for 75p or whatever. It sort of varies hugely. In Greece, for that month, that bottle, which is a very sort of important commodity in Greece, because, of course, it's hot and you don't trust the water that you get from the tap, so you drink a lot of that, it was reduced to 50 cents, or whatever it is, the equivalent. It has remained 50 cents since. It's the only thing that is, I really enjoy buying Greece because I know it's cheaper than anything else, whereas everything else is so much more expensive. Everything slightly above the standard size can be anything, but that has remained the same. It's a legacy of the past, like the control of the price of bread and all sorts of things. But they did that and a few other things and managed to get themselves just into the margin of error and were able to enter. But since then, of course, there's no way that that Greece could actually keep the deficit GDP ratio requirements or the inflation requirements or anything else. But that wouldn't have mattered very much. What really mattered for Greece and all the other countries that I mentioned is that instead of doing anything very much about the productive capacity, they just imported loads of things. Now, what happens in a currency area of this sort? What were supposed to be the benefits of having the euro? Of course, what you had was a disparate set of countries, some rich, some poor. The expectation was that the poorer countries would become richer over the period because there'd be quite a lot of currency inflows. They have cheaper credit, so greater availability. They'd be able to borrow and expand and invest and all that sort of stuff. And their wages will start going up because, of course, they will have to get richer over a period and faster than the, obviously, because they're more mature economies, because they will get all this influx of money, blah, blah, and they would get richer. And their wages, if you look across, you know, big international companies couldn't pay, you know, the Greeks so much less than they paid the Germans. So over a period, inevitably, you'd have a higher increase in wages of those countries and a lower, if not stable, increase in places like Germany, which is precisely what happened. But in the process, of course, unless you do something about your productive potential and your productivity, you lose competitiveness. It was obvious. A number of us who were anti the euro at the time were saying precisely that. Watch this because the countries will be uncompetitive. And then there is a shock and there is nothing they can do. What they will do is, let's say you're a pharmaceutical company, you're looking at your strategy for Europe. And I was advising lots of companies at the time on what to do because of the change in, they had to have conversion rates back into euro from whatever they were doing before. And they had to restructure themselves to be able to organize it on a euro basis and look at the prices and what have you. We said to pharmaceutical companies, well, there is a shock. Those countries will have no ability to deal with it, so they're going to just slash government spending. They slash government spending. Who's going to pay for your pharmaceutical products? It's precisely what's going on right now in places like Greece. So when you go to Greece, get on the plane, they seem to be quite full. I would suggest that a very substantial percentage of those people on the plane are people going back to Greece, trying to get the money back somehow or other, or taking them to court because they haven't been paid. And what is really, really worrying is that in the way in which some of those adjustments have been made, and Greece, interestingly enough, is going to move to a primary surplus next year. For those of you who don't know the details of what this means, is that if you look at how much a government spends on current spending to people it employs or anything else it buys, not capital, current, and then you look at how much it collects in terms of taxes, what is really important is that they are in surplus or at least in balance. They should really be in surplus because in addition to that, if they have debt, they have to pay the debt interest, okay? And the debt interest in places like Greece is rather large. So Greece is moving to a primary surplus, and the reason why it's doing that is it's managing just about to collect a bit more tax right now, and so are some of the other countries. But actually, it's not spending, so the government isn't spending. It's not paying its contractors. So this isn't a very healthy position to be in. And those of you who have followed what's been going on in Greece, I mean, Greece reached the point where it did slash its deficit very significantly in year one of the crisis. It was then very obvious that it would get no serious support from, or at least that's what was the word on the street, and that's what Merkel and Sarkozy said, that the risk in lending to Greece was back with the private sector, really. So it found itself unable to borrow in the foreign exchange market, in the bond markets, which is exactly what then happened in Italy and Spain and Portugal and Ireland and then Cyprus. So those countries can no longer go and borrow in those markets. They have to rely on the European Central Bank and the IMF to bail them out. And that is why there are bailouts in all these places. Now, Greece managed to really reduce its deficit very substantially by a good 5 points in year one between 2009 and 2010. Then everyone realized that actually there was a huge risk because the debt was probably never going to be repaid. Greece was unable to borrow. I mean, rates went zoomed up. And as I said, it happened to other countries as well. And then, of course, they were given bailouts. Loads of money, the biggest bailouts you've ever seen. totaling 230 billion in Greece, which is huge. The largest bailout that the International Monetary Fund had dealt with before was 33 billion in Brazil. So we're talking about something enormous. Now, the Germans say, why should we do this with Greece right now when they're just never going to be able to do the things they're supposed to do? You may indeed agree with this. But it is worth saying, just to link to the point I was making about the primary surplus, that out of the second bailout, they had two of them, the second one that was agreed in February of this year, no money's come into Greece at all, but most of the 110 billion that we're meant to get was going to recapitalize the banking system, to pay for the interest on the loans, and to help the banks that had all taken part in a haircut, as it was called, which was there to, which basically meant that they had to give up about 50%, if slightly more, of what they were owed by the Greeks in some sort of deal that was done. So they got a haircut. They lost 50% of what they were due to be paid by the Greeks. So you ended up with this agreement being made, with all this money supposedly going to recapitalize the banks, and with only 6 billion out of that huge figure I gave you going directly to the Greek economy. And that was going straight just to pay the contractors. So it isn't exactly as if tons of money has come in, which the Germans have been worrying about, keeping the Greeks on the beach and not doing anything. Actually, it was going to pay for all those pharmaceutical companies I was mentioning before. And the rest was going to make sure the banking system operated. Right now, you can't get a mortgage in Greece. Right now, you can't get a loan in Greece. And if you're trying to trade between Greece and the UK, nobody accepts the bank's letters of credit, which are issued in Greece. So you can't have trade. And you'd say, it's just Greece. But if you look across Europe, lending has dropped very significantly. In all those places, because of the concerns that there are about the banks and the fact that they need to recapitalize themselves, there's been deleveraging. Everyone's been cutting back and not lending to their businesses. So we have a Eurozone which is at best stagnant, but actually about to see a drop in recession. The latest forecasts are for an increase of 0.1% in GDP next year. But if anyone does any modelling, you know that 0.1% increase could easily be 1% decline. And of course, given all the austerity measures introduced all across the Eurozone, the likelihood of a decline is very significant. So what has happened? How will this crisis ever be resolved? I think with difficulty. In fact, with huge difficulty. But there is one very, very good sign. And this is why Greece is important. I didn't think of the title, Greekonomics. It was thought out by my publishers, and I would always regret not thinking about this first. But actually, Greece has been a catalyst. I majored a bit on Greece, although the book actually talks about the Eurozone, looks at Spain, looks at the view from Germany, it looks at UK views on Europe and the euro and so on. But what has happened is really quite dramatic. I mentioned the IMF, which has been very instrumental in all this, because as you probably know, the way in which the bailouts have been agreed, they have involved the European Central Bank, the European countries, the European Union, and also the International Monetary Fund, which has been putting a little bit of its money. But the most important role of the IMF has been as a supervisor of the whole process and the conditions that they put on these countries. Now, because of the previous experience, the International Monetary Fund had calculated that if you withdraw some money out of the economy, let's say we withdraw 1% out of the economy, then what you get is a 0.5% decline in GDP as a result, and you can then perhaps make up because of other ways in which you can manage your economy. Now, these multipliers have been rethought. What they think is that actually the cost to the economy can be so much greater that, in fact, it defeats the whole purpose of the exercise. And that's the point that I'm making also in the book, but I wrote it before the IMF came out with this view, which is that actually austerity can lead you to, in fact, you know, if people decide not to spend, you can't collect taxes. And if you have more people unemployed, you have to pay them unemployment benefit, you spend more in the economy yourself. What it does is it makes your aim to achieve fiscal consolidation, reduce your deficit, reduce your debt to GDP level, much more difficult. And in fact, it could lead to the opposite being the case. In other words, the more austerity, the worse it gets in terms of achieving your targets. And I think Greece has shown that this is indeed the case. Now, just to get the figures into perspective, for those of you who haven't followed this, Greece has had 5 years of decline in GDP. It means that by the end of this year, output will have been reduced by 20% in real terms. And through this internal devaluation that has taken place, incomes have gone down by 30 to 35%. Greece has become as cheap as Romania in terms of producing, but its inflation has stayed high because of taxes and other reasons, energy costs and so on. So you can imagine, I mean, who can go out and spend unless you had lots of money under the mattress or you had moved lots of money through corruption out into Swiss bank accounts, which apparently loads of them did. This famous list has materialized now with all these names of Greeks who had tens of millions of euros when they were declaring income of 10,000, for example. So especially if everyone deleverages at the same time, if everyone around you is cutting, if the banks are cutting, the government is cutting, where is the growth going to come from? So the IMF has finally come with that conclusion. The European Commission has a long way to go until it understands it. It's produced this report, which says that actually, although austerity may matter a bit, it's the lack of confidence in the economy that's done. It's the lack of confidence in those governments, in their ability to repay back the debt. So what we need is more austerity. So you still haven't quite, we haven't quite won the battle, but at least the IMF has now come with what is this new orthodoxy, saying that in fact austerity perhaps doesn't pay. So for me, there is only one solution. It is for the debt to be written off to a considerable extent across Europe, because the levels that we have of debt at present across Europe, not just Greece, with no growth, are unsustainable, and they're going to be bringing Europe down on a constant basis. And until that is done, across and not just with Greece, then we're not going to see any growth taking place at all. And at least the IMF's sort of conversion is showing the way towards achieving some of that. And also what they're asking now for Greece, finally, which is part of that, which is anathema from anything else that I said before, to anything else they said before, is moving us that way. And what does it mean for the UK if we don't get that solution? It means the Eurozone, to which the UK exports 50% of its goods, doing so badly that the economy here too would be dragged down, and the banking issues that have been so evident all across Europe will get, if anything, worse. So doom and gloom unless these things happen, but I think there are some signs that people are waking up to the huge severity of the issue, and with the IMF at the forefront. But it's taken so long that now the cost of remedying what's happened is actually huge, and some more imaginative solutions will need to be found. Not just the banking union that everyone's talking about, and not just the sort of fiscal pact of the sort they're talking about. All these are longer-term issues. There's now an urgent need to act, and that's basically what the book is saying. I will stop here and take some questions.